Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, we did this interview for this podcast just as the pandemic was beginning to emerge as part of our regular lives. And I don't know how the pandemic has affected all of this, but it's about workloads. And it's about the fact that a lot of young people today are consumed by their jobs and the technology that follows them everywhere they go. Thus, their work can find them wherever they are. And some of the boundaries that we have established over the years, 9 to 5, if you will, have just been ripped and shredded apart. So this book called Overload, How Good Jobs Went Bad and What We Can Do About It, is really about high-paying jobs. That, you know, it used to be, well, the boss could really put upon you if you were a low-income guy and they really had control, but not the professionals. But now the professionals have been swamped and overwhelmed. But with the pandemic, John, what I'm really wondering is, how has that changed the equation?
Well, I wonder that myself, because you still need personal contact, I think, with the people you work with at some point. But do you need this one big building to go to? I mean, I don't know how big business is really going to change with the pandemic.
Well,
are they
going
to allow
things,
you to work from home more?
Right. One of the things I found, we had two young professionals working out of the house for the last 3 weeks, my daughter and her fiance. And my daughter really likes it. She set up her double screens, and she was doing her training programs with young people trying to get into IT from other countries and helping them with work-related skills and so forth. And I was listening in. It was really fascinating to listen to her counseling them, and then they'd go into breakout groups and then come back and talk about what it was that they discussed about their approach when they go in for a job interview and such. But then her fiancé, he doesn't like it. I mean, he does design in terms of apps and such, and he really doesn't like working at home. He likes being part of the group. And I thought about it myself. If I was still in the day-to-day workforce, how would I be responding to all this? And I don't think I'd be doing terribly well. I like to be in that work environment.
Well, I think you need that give and take, and especially if you're working on a particular project or you're working on something. You know, I don't know if you get that from working, you know, remotely.
Well, they try to simulate that,
yeah,
with Zoom meetings, with a lot of phone calls, with a lot of appointed times to be doing this, that, and the other. So they really try to make it look as if it's a structured work day, but still, the kitchen's right down the hall.
Right. You got the dog.
You've got the dog.
And then you got the internet problem, bandwidth. Which is huge, which, you know, we got to address if we're going to do this. We need a much better infrastructure with the internet because, as you know, and we know, that's a big problem.
Well, even I've been doing, obviously, all the podcasts out of the house. And during the real height of the pandemic here in New England, in March and April, I was having a lot of difficulty, as you know.
Yeah, I know. It's
because I send all that difficulty right on to John, and he's got to make it sound good.
Yeah, so these are problems that we're going to have to face if then you got the of course the kids doing some remote learning. I don't know how the school's going to look, but that's going to play. And if you're working from home and they're doing schoolwork, I mean, here again, bandwidth problems and who knows.
Yeah, and we're not even talking about the problem that a working mom or dad trying to homeschool in part, or at least to oversee how they're interacting with teachers. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, the ramifications from all of this are just absolutely tremendous and almost unfathomable as to the impacts. But the book that we're talking about today, Overload, is really about when we had kind of a normal work environment and the fact that a lot of professionals really have blurred all of the lines and now they're working all the time. And one, I guess, could argue that if you're working out of your home, you're still working, but you're at home. And so there really are no demarcations and that might continue unabated. It's different, but it still has the same impact on your life.
Well, that sounds pretty stressful.
Well, don't forget when we did Dying for a Paycheck. You remember that book focused on? And the same thing, that there are many maladies that come about because people are feeling so stressed. Well, the author that we bring on today is Erin Kelly. She, along with Phyllis Moen, wrote this book. And, John, they drew on 5 years of research. They did hundreds of interviews with employees, with managers, and then they set up this experiment where they helped to design a Fortune 500 firm in the way that they thought it would work best for both the management and the employees to show that you don't have to just beat people into the ground with work all of the time to get the most out of them. And I always found that because, John, I always manage creative people. And you could never treat a producer of a television program the way you would a line assembly worker. They just think differently. Right. The way they may be working their best at 1 o'clock in the morning while they're sitting in an edit bay and you're not even there. So you can't expect that if they're not on their real top form at 9 o'clock in the morning that that means anything.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. But, you know, I used to, in TV though, I used to, really, it was really bad when the directors beat it up on the producers. I thought that was just horrible. Well, I saw some horrible stuff.
You know, if you like television, law, or bacon, don't watch any of them being made. You know, terrible stuff. Well, Erin Kelly, the Sloan Distinguished Professor of Work and Organization Studies at MIT, John, is joining us today. I know that's a level of gravitas that we try to rise to on occasion here on this podcast. She is with us today to talk about overload. Erin Kelly.
Welcome back to America Trends. With me on the line is Erin Kelly. She's the co-author of a book, along with Phyllis Moen, called Overload, How Good Jobs Went Bad and What We Can Do About It. And, you know, it's interesting that you write this book. I interviewed another author who wrote a book called Dying for a Paycheck, and it became pretty clear to me that the work environment today is different than it was in the past. The always-on culture, the sense that, you know, we have to have efficiency and we have to be there and available just about any time of day. And I'm a little bit past my working years where I'm in that grind, but I can tell a difference. And yet, when I talk to some other people, they dismiss the notion that this is really going on or that it's any worse than it was for those of us who really had our great moments in the 80s, the 90s, and such. Tell me what you say about that.
That's a great question. I think we are seeing an increase in overload. And let me tell you what overload means so you can track this answer. We use the term overload to refer to the sense that there's just too much to do, that you're being asked to tackle too much at work, and so you feel rushed and overwhelmed, and as you said, always on, always feeling pressure to check your emails, check your text, respond to things electronically. And I think that has shifted over the last 10 to 15 years. That sense of overload is sometimes driven by downsizing, by the fact that people are asked to do the job of 3 or 4 or up to 10 people as companies have gotten leaner. And that's true in the public sector and in some parts of education and healthcare too. And then another shift is that these technologies allow managers and clients and coworkers to think that they can reach you at any hour of the day and night. And so they go ahead and try to do that. So I think work hours have not increased that dramatically, but we have much less time when we're completely off of work and we feel driven to do everything we can to prove ourselves in the context of companies that are often downsizing, of fears of automation, of just, you know, this sense that you've got to run fast, even if it's tough to do so.
And I do want to get into your book because it's fascinating. I mean, you did a real-world study in a major Fortune 500 company to validate what the thought process was about overload. But let me go back to the notion that I think is most critical in your research and in the notion of overload, and that is responding to the immediate instead of the most consequential. And I think that's really one of the key elements in this that I came away with.
Yes, I think that we have a sense of urgency and people are rewarded by their bosses and by others based on how quickly they respond and, you know, how actively they're participating in the group chat or, you know, long emails that involve many, many people, rather than employees and managers stepping back and getting focused on what it is that needs to be done. So there's this sense of franticness. There's not a sense of setting priorities. In a way, we know that good management is about seeing the big picture and, you know, plotting a path towards your long-term goals. But our work cultures have ramped up and rewarded this instant responsiveness instead.
Now, somebody listening to this might say, oh, it's all about the technology. That's the issue here, that we're all so connected and these phones are now you know, something that we are slavish to. Is it really about the technology or is that just an adjunct to what's going on here?
I would say more of an adjunct. Now, of course, we know that the technologies are tempting and that we could probably all be more disciplined with regard to how often we pick up our phones. But technology itself isn't the issue. It's the tool that allows companies and managers to ask more of people and expect them to try to do more as well. So in our book, we study in particular a group of IT professionals and managers in a Fortune 500 company. And what's really clear from that particular case is that it's the global staffing strategy, it's the decision to send so much of the work offshore. That means the U.S. employees are running scared and trying to do everything they can to prove that they should still stick around.
So they've got a couple of things that they're dealing with. You say there's more intensity, less security. They're worried about losing the job to a lower priced but highly competent person in another country. They're worried about AI. They see a lot of empty desks around them, so they know that this process is already, to some extent, well underway.
That's right. That's a great summary. It's both the changes in technology, the changes in staffing strategies by U.S. firms, the worries about growing insecurity and how automation may change things. And that all comes together to create this very fast-paced and frantic and anxious work environment.
And these are professionals, as you say, IT professionals. And now we're speaking in the midst of this coronavirus response and this tragic event that's occurring. And we see what these frontline workers are going through and the fact that we are automating a lot of those jobs at a very rapid pace and they have very little security. So it's probably magnified in different work classes.
Certainly. In our book, we focus on professionals and managers, and we focus on the fact that these are good jobs by many standards, and look at both what the challenges are and what we can do to make work more sustainable and productive in those settings. But all along, we acknowledge the reality that frontline workers, especially those in the service sector, have it worse. Their schedules are less predictable. If you're paid hourly and your hours go up and down, then of course your income goes up and down, and that creates an additional source of stress. In the wake of the coronavirus crisis, we see people in the service sector losing their jobs in very large numbers. And of course, even no matter how stressful a job is, it's usually less stressful than being unemployed and, you know, really worried about financial security and feeding your family.
That's an excellent point. Let me ask you about the generations in all of this, because I've got some millennials in my family, and they work awfully hard, and they're always on. It's exactly what you say in your book, two of them in advertising in New York City, so you can only imagine what that's about. But then you've got the Gen Xers, then you've got the baby boomers like me who are still in the workforce, trying to accommodate to a pace that is so rigorous. And I've got to believe, as you suggest in the book, it has an impact on your health, your well-being, but that has a negative impact on what it is this is supposed to do, this always on, which is to get more out of you than perhaps is even humanly possible.
Well, I think the question of generations is an interesting one. I would say that overload is hitting people at all ages and at all life stages. And in a little bit, I expect we'll talk about what we could do to tame overload and try to create a better work environment. But it is true that often younger workers, millennials and the generation that is coming after them, have grown up in this atmosphere and entered the labor market at a time when kind of having a standard through path for your career is not that common. And so this concern about proving yourself through your availability, through your willingness to work long hours, to pick up and go for any reason at any moment, that is something that millennials often feel is the only way to establish themselves in careers. Then, of course, you have that midlife group of people who have, you know, really active responsibilities for young children, sometimes caregiving for older adults. And that are the work-family dilemmas that are so familiar to many people. And then you have older workers in, say, 50s, 60s, 70s who want to be engaged, know that they can contribute important things in their work organizations, but feel like their only choice is to go full-time, full tilt, crazy hours, or to back off completely and leave. And that's really unfortunate because it means we're losing the talent and expertise of that older generation. At the same time, we're wearing down the midlife adults and we're training the younger adults to work in ways that are not sustainable either.
And in some sense, we are assuring ourselves that we're going to have fewer of these knowledge workers going forward, because if you're a knowledge worker today, even within an environment like the one that you've studied, and it's as difficult for you, and you are not in the gig economy per se, where you're out there all on your own. The gig economy, to me, is another word for freelancing, and that's altogether another stressful environment with less certainty than almost anything. And you're a professor of work and organizational studies. You look at it, and you say to yourself, these kids, and I'm calling them kids because I'm in my 60s, they really don't want to have large families. So we're going to have fewer workers coming up in the future, and that's going to make it even more difficult because we're going to push them even harder. Because I had a demographer on recently who said every child born after 1985 is more valuable to our society than those born before it.
I think it's a great point that social demographers study how economic conditions, in particular social policies, affect people's willingness to have families. But another part of that story is as people try to establish themselves and find a secure foothold in young adulthood, if they're not able to do that, then it's really going to constrain their options for family formation.
Exactly. And of course, women who have entered the workforce in a profound way and making incredible contributions, they're graduating colleges more often than men. They are so important to us. I mean, the struggles that they have and the challenges and all of them coming all together in their late 20s and early 30s is pretty profoundly crushing, I would imagine, to them psychologically as to which way to go.
Well, I think that it's important to acknowledge the work-family challenges that women often face and the ways that gender kind of differentiates what we expect of mothers versus what we expect of fathers. It's really important to acknowledge that reality. At the same time, sometimes a work-family story that focuses on how tough it is for working moms narrows our vision and our understanding too much. And one of the things that we really learned, Phyllis Moen and I learned through the course of this research, was how broad the pain was and how many men, both fathers and those who didn't have young kids at home, also felt like what they were asked to do at work was just not feasible and not sustainable and affecting their health as well. So on the one hand, yes, there are these work family challenges that do hit women harder. And on the other hand, if we focus only or narrowly on the work family challenges, we lose sight of this broader problem.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Overload, how good jobs went bad and what we can do about it. Erin Kelly is with us. She's the co-author of this book along with Phyllis Moen. One of the interesting things in your book, and help me understand this, because at the beginning I thought you said that perhaps we're not really talking about longer hours here. And yet I read in the book, you said the trend is more complicated than it appears. And somehow with all the on switches that never go off at night on the weekends, 6:30 mm-hmm. conference calls on a Saturday, preparing for these kinds of things, that we're looking at four additional 40-hour weeks during the work year for many of these folks.
Well, the trend that you're speaking to about increased work hours and that turning into four additional work weeks is largely driven by us taking fewer vacations and by the fact that more women have moved into the workforce in recent decades, as you mentioned before. When we look at kind of average hours, we see that average doesn't help us understand things. That there are growing longer hours among professional and managerial workers and more dual income households, so the family has more total hours spent in paid work. And then on the other end of the income spectrum, there are more people who aren't getting the hours that they would like and need. The gig workers, the retail workers, and restaurant workers who aren't getting as many hours as they would like. And so that's what I meant about, you know, if you just look at average hours, it's not so easy to see a change because there's different things going on in different parts of the labor market.
I mean, that's the other thing. I worked as a salaried professional for so many years, and I never really kept track of my time. It was just my time, and it was to do what it was that I needed to do for my organization. So really, real hours versus those that are documented. The other thing about hours is you tell us that everybody wants to be there if their boss is there. And I remember a great study that I read when I was going for my master's about the boss coming in at 6:30 in the morning. So everybody mm-hmm. felt they had to be there at that time because he was going to be there. And everybody started coming in earlier and earlier, but there were no assistants. There was no email at that time. There was no phone calling. So it was very unproductive for everybody to come in the office at 6:30. So finally, they pulled up that practice and said, stop, come in at a regular time. Mm-hmm. I know you want to be here to impress the boss, but there's a lot of that going on too, that if you're not available on Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening for a call, that doesn't look like you're terribly a big company person.
That's right. That's that pressure for FaceTime, this pressure to be visible and visibly busy, to show your worth by showing how many hours you're working. And then with technologies, what's happened is that's kind of spread out. So there is no time when many people feel they can just turn it off and not focus on the work. They feel this need to always be monitoring so that they can show that they are a team player and really committed. Even though we know that stretching our work hours that way and, you know, interspersing work and the rest of life doesn't allow for full recovery, for, you know, rest, recuperation, creative thinking. And so in the medium and long term, that kind of instant responsiveness means we're not doing our best work.
Are there any differences between startups and established companies? The company that you looked at, and again, we will get at some of the solutions, but are there any differences? Startups seem as if they must be really exhaustive in terms of the human capability because everybody's there to prove that they can make it in this very insecure environment to begin with.
Well, I think startups have a lot of positive stress in the sense that, you know, you're hoping that you're in on the ground floor of something that's going to take off. And so people may be motivated to work long hours and to jump in and do everything they can because they're genuinely excited about the new product or service, or they're genuinely excited about the fact that the company may grow. Whereas the established company that we studied had been in a mode of shrinking, of downsizing and offshoring. And so that was more of anxiety-driven stress, you know, a fear of losing your own job. I would say, though, even in startups, when there's only an overloaded way of working, when that's the only legitimate way of contributing, you're not going to attract the talent that you might if you had a more flexible and broader vision of what it takes to be a good startup employee. So I think even in startups, there's a cost to the current practices that's not always recognized.
You say that this insecurity limits dissent. And of course, dissent is a really important thing in the workplace. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, having new ideas and somebody saying, I don't think this groupthink is going to work for us. Let me give you another idea here. But what are the other implications of all of this? I mean, we've talked about the health implications, the work-life balance, but what in practical sense within the workplace does this sense of insecurity drive as bad outcomes for the company itself?
That's a great question. What we saw in this IT context was that employees knew the deadlines they had been given were unrealistic, and they knew that they did not have adequate staff to build the software in the way that they would have wanted to as, you know, committed and dedicated professionals. But they felt pressure to just get it done. So we heard story after story of slapping things together and hoping to get back to it, and this kind of cycle of firefighting where the current projects need to be pushed out the door, and then you get the old projects, the problems that were revealed when those programs were launched become clear, and you're trying to make those corrections and fix those bugs in this case, even as the next project comes after you. So the IT professionals we studied were really dedicated to their craft, but they felt they couldn't do the good work that they wanted to do. And again, partly that was because they felt it wasn't safe to say no or to raise questions about whether a particular deadline was feasible.
Now, a solution that you and Phyllis came up with called dual agenda work design. Explain what that means to us. And then I want to get into a complication that occurred in the course of you conducting this. Things are moving along pretty well as you're working toward this dual agenda work design.
Dual agenda work redesign is an opportunity to rethink when, where, and how you do your work, and to actively express support for people as people, not just in their work roles, but to acknowledge their personal and family roles. I should be clear that we developed this initiative as part of the Work, Family, and Health Research Network. So it was a large interdisciplinary group of scholars, plus we brought in some organizational development consultants who had expertise in this area, and we developed this initiative together. Basically, whole teams would sit down together and say, what are the problems with the way that we're working currently? What would it be like if each of us had more control or more say over how we put our days together? Part of that is working from home, but that's just a part of it. And then the team would work together to identify, are there meetings that we can cut? What would happen if we stopped having a status update every day from 9 to 10 a.m. and instead, used a dashboard or a tool differently? People would ask questions like, would it be feasible for me to turn off my email and my IM, a chat program, for a couple of hours each morning or each afternoon so that I could actually do my heads down thinking knowledge work during the workday? Before that, people had routinely pushed their real work, using their terminology, their real work to evenings and weekends, and spent the whole day just in meetings and catching up and email correspondence and text correspondence. And so the dual agenda work redesign helps people see that there could be a different way of working that would be better for them personally and allow them to do better work.
And so how long did this go on, and what were the results that you saw?
Sure. We tested this with a really rigorous design. So we did a true field experiment where we divided, you can think of them as teams. They were really kind of like small departments. We divided 56 teams in half, and half of them went through our work redesign initiative, and the other half continued operating with the usual company policies. So we had data before, during, and then once the work redesign had launched, after the work redesign, for almost 1,000 employees, and we could carefully track how these changes in work practices and the work environment were affecting them. We found that there were real and significant benefits for employees and for the company. So employees liked it. Not a huge surprise there, but employees liked it with regards to feeling more job satisfaction, feeling less stress. They reported less psychological distress, which is just a preclinical measure of poor mental health, and that psychological distress decreased. And they felt less burned out. The company benefited because employees were more satisfied and probably more engaged and excited about their work, and they were less likely to leave the firm as compared to the people doing the same type of jobs within the same company. So that reduced turnover can be translated into a return on investment that is about 1.6. So in other words, if the company had paid for every moment of the training initiative and, you know, costed out every minute that employees spent in this training, they still would have seen $1.60 worth of benefits for each dollar that they had spent.
Now, the interesting thing in all of this is that we've heard that one of the big insecurities today is that companies are so changeable, that financial results are so immediate, quarterly, so much pressure from the financial markets for so many companies, and that's putting all this downward pressure even into the IT department of a company. But I found it very ironic and in some ways put a real accent on what we're talking about when in the middle of this turnover that you're talking about in terms of the way that work is designed and carried out, that the company was sold and there are new executives that come in. And that's exactly what's always hovering over people today, is that everything feels like it's in a state of flux.
It is a hard reality that you can, you can have a team of scientists come into a company and really carefully and rigorously test something. The workers can love it. The frontline managers can love it. The VPs can be on board and excited about it. But in this case, the firm that we were studying was acquired, and the new top management team found this. They weren't ready for it. It was not something that they had chosen themselves, and it did not align with how the acquiring firm's corporate culture was set up. And so a couple of years after that acquisition, the firm basically reverted to existing company policies and pulled back from all of the work redesign changes that we had studied.
And isn't that the point?
I think it's really hard
in today's work environment and business climate for any of this to go forward, because it's the way that virtually all of these companies seem to be operating in the moment, not for the long term, and not really focused necessarily on keeping people, because they feel they can churn and that there are always new, younger, cheaper employees to fill those positions.
Larry, you're a little more pessimistic than me, even though I am. I was very much dismayed by that. And let me share two reasons that I think there's a possibility for optimism here. One is that employees and managers who'd been through the work redesign initiative accepted the change in policies, but they did not go back in their own thinking. It no longer made sense to them to work in the old ways. They had this internal critique going, and to some extent, it was a quiet collective critique. And so they were looking for opportunities to work differently. You didn't have to convince them. You had to, because they had lived a different, saner and more enjoyable work life. And so going forward, they were looking to be a part of corporate cultures that were open to those new ways of working. The second direction for optimism is that public policies can set a new floor. Now, it is hard to imagine exactly how we go from the current practices to, different type of labor legislation. But I think the coronavirus and the current bout of unemployment is going to set us up to have some serious conversations about how we work differently and how we have some new protections for workers of all kinds, frontline workers in the service sector, as well as professionals in other sectors.
Well, we're not over the hill with it at this moment as we're speaking, but what are those changes in work-life balance, in working from home? I mean, are there changes that you see that are very likely to come about as a result of what we've been through?
Well, obviously, the coronavirus is a terrible public health threat, and we can't minimize the stress and worries that many people are facing at this point. At the same time, we this current crisis is pushing us to learn how to work from home and to see that company policies and practices, as well as public policies, probably need to be updated. So it's my hope that after this period of crisis, managers and employees can together use this disruption to do some of the things that are similar to what we study, to really reflect on how they'd like to work together, to build on some of the current habits that we're developing with regard to asking about each other's health and family as part of conversations, you know, to try to express support for each other more fully, and to be wary of overload, right? To recognize that, yes, we can work from home, but at the same time, we need to be sure that we're not connected to work all of the time, and to recognize that we can kind of take charge of these work practices. But that needs to happen through conversations at the workplace and in our broader society. It's always risky for one person to try to, you know, make a change, and that people would legitimately worry that they would not be seen as a team player and put their jobs at risk. But if we can use this moment to have a different set of conversations about what do we need from each other and what can we expect of our organizations and of our public safety net, then that would be one step forward.
All right. That's a great way to end this conversation. Erin Kelly, co-author of Overload with Phyllis Moen. She's with the MIT School of Management, the Sloan Management Group there, and a wonderful presentation in this book. I encourage you, if you've really been interested in what we've been talking about, go to the book and check it out, and perhaps you can make some changes in your own workplace if you're in management or in the way that you look at work going forward. Again, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.